Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast The Literary Nosy Parkers. I'm your book inspector, Daisy Buchanan. I'm the author of How to Be a Grown-Up and The Sisterhood, and my very first novel, Insatiable, A Story for Greedy Girls, is coming out on the 11th of February 2021. It's the story of Violet, broke, broken-hearted, vulnerable, and what happens when she starts to fall for a glossy, glamorous grown-up couple who might be offering her a dream job, a dream life, alongside some seriously sexy adventures. Marion Keyes says it's extremely funny, touching and wonderfully refreshing on women and sexual desire. Dolly Alderton says it's as filthy as it is funny. You won't be able to put it down. Insatiable will be available online and from bookshops, and there is a limited number of special signed editions available from Waterstones for Your Book listeners to pre-order. If you're a regular listener and you've already pre-ordered, thank you with all my heart. I love you. It really is the best possible way for you to support Your Book. Now, on to today's guest. Writer and comedian Adam Kay doesn't really need an introduction, but let's give him one anyway. His book, This Is Going to Hurt, his hilarious and moving and devastating account of his time as a junior doctor, made him a household name. He's the patron saint of 2020, if 2020 has been the year of recognising, appreciating and fretting over the NHS. He's won 4 National Book Awards, and his first children's book, Kay's Anatomy, A Complete and Completely Disgusting Guide to the Human Body, has just been released. We talked about the history of the fart joke, casting Sandy Toksvig to play the human brain, and why we really need to stop reading on the toilet. So congratulations on Kay's Anatomy. How are you feeling about it all?
Yeah, it's had a good start. Yeah, just sort of don't really know what's going on at all in general at the moment.
That's very much the theme of 2020. I saw something on Twitter that really made me laugh. A very grumpy, angry man was complaining, I think, because Kay's Anatomy talks about where the clitoris is, and said something like, "That's useful information for me, but not for a child."
Yeah, that was really extraordinary because, first of all, obviously, all the stuff about reproduction we'd done with loads of input from sex ed experts, and the whole book is done in discussion with curriculum experts, just so we got it right. And also, the fact of the matter is, not only is his daughter already learning this stuff at school, but it's crucial that they do, because we know that it isn't just important information, but God forbid that kids, you know, ever have to report abuse. We know that people who know more about their anatomy are more likely to report it and more likely to adequately explain what's been going on. So, but yeah, I mean, all publicity is good publicity. And most of the replies to that tweet were people saying, "Oh, I should get this book for my kids." I think lots of adults have been buying the book, and I mean, I don't expect adults to know what's in the book. In fact, when I sent the book off to friends who are doctors to do fact checks on this and check I hadn't missed anything or said anything totally bananas, every single one of them pointed out the fact that they hadn't they hadn't known as doctors. Because, I mean, there's a lot of the body to know about, and kids will doubtless ask a lot of questions. We can't expect everyone to remember what they may or may not have learnt in GCSE biology.
Do you have a favourite fact? Is there anything thrillingly weird and clever our bodies do that we don't know about? Sorry, that might be something you've been asked a lot.
No. I love talking about the body facts, because, I mean, there's basically so many of them. What's my favourite? The one that the doctors never knew about was the existence of something called GOUND, GOUND, which is the sleep that you get in your eyes, which is basically sort of dried up mucus and a bit of dried up tears and a bit of dead skin cells, but it's got a name. And normally during the day we're blinking all the time, our eyes are washing themselves and it doesn't accumulate. But yeah, it's got a name. You spend a year of your life on the toilet. You spend a month of every year blinking. Your heart pumps 7,000 litres of blood a day, which is about 90 baths worth. Don't do that. Your blood contains gold.
Ooh.
Not much. I mean, it isn't a viable sort of career.
Oh, God. I can see the adverts now. Cash for blood.
You'd have to, I think, take a whole football stadium's worth of people to get enough blood to make like a signet ring or something. If you unfolded your brain, it would be the size of a pillow. Saliva you produce in a day would fill two cans of Coke. The longest ever fart was 3 minutes. there's a lot in there. And in the book, I've majored on the disgusting stuff quite a lot because I want kids to read it and like it.
You know your target audience. Like.
but also, in a sort of ninja learning thing, it does still have absolutely all the human biology that they need to know.
You're talking about spending a year of our lives on the toilet, and I would wonder whether readers perhaps spend more than a year of their lives on the toilet.
Maybe. Well, they shouldn't. You shouldn't read on the toilet, because you're more likely to get hemorrhoids by spending unnecessary time on the toilet. So spend the requisite amount of time on the toilet and take your book through to the bedroom or the living room and finish your reading then.
That is the health tip that our listeners desperately need.
When I was a medical student, the gastroenterologist, the gut doctor who I was training under, would say how every time he went to a friend's house, he would sweep all the books out of the toilet and tell them the damage they were doing. So I'm not quite at that level, but that is my public service announcement for your book.
What kind of a reader are you? Like, when do you read, and what's your relationship with books like?
I can't really say this, it's embarrassing, but I've never really been a huge reader. When I got my first book deal for This Is Going to Hurt, I was very conscious that I wasn't the right person to write a book, because, you know, I hadn't done any English or anything since GCSE, and I associated books with being what other clever people did, who like read much more than I did. And in fact, it took me a while of the publisher sort of banging on at me to ask me to sign that before I actually agreed. But what I did do is I bought a big load of books about how to write, and I read a big load of blogs, and I listened to a big load of stuff. They all disagreed with each other about how you should do it. Interestingly, none of the people who were writing books about how to write books, which seems to be a huge industry, seemed to have any success whatsoever in writing books. But anyway, I remember this Somerset Maugham quote. You might know about, there are three golden rules for writing a novel, but unfortunately no one knows what they are. So they all disagreed apart from one single point, which was, it's all about reading. Read, 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 you know. And I was like, oh no, well this reaffirms all of my concerns, because I'm probably like, I read like most people do. I get some books at Christmas. I occasionally, you know, see something that catches my eye in the window of a shop. Mostly read on holiday, sometimes read at bedtime, but often don't because I'm just knackered after work. So I've never been like a mega, mega reader. I'm now reading more than I've ever read because people send me books all the time and lots of them look fascinating. Lots of them I just feel very guilty and lots of them are written by my friends, so I have to read. So I'm a crap reader. And actually when I was putting the book together, because I was assembling diary entries and just sort of twiddling with them rather than starting from scratch, I deliberately didn't read anything that I might inadvertently nick. So, like, I adore David Sedaris, Nora Ephron, Alan Bennett, and, you know, those sort of people who tell the stories of their lives like that, Bill Bryson. And I sort of made sure that I stayed away from all of that in case I unwittingly wrote a David Sedaris tribute act.
I think that is incredibly interesting. And I'm always really excited when someone says, I'm not really much of a reader, because I think that, but yeah, as you say, that's how so many people read. And I think reading is a new and sort of terrible form of, you know, wellness. I've always been a reader, but I think it is made to feel like, oh, it's that grown-up homework that will never, ever leave you. But I suspect, and this sounds really sycophantic, but the reason why This Is Going to Hurt struck such an enormous chord and has been, you know, such a huge success is obviously the writing is so brilliant and it's so universal, but also you were able to write a book knowing how good a book had to be to get through to the non-reader, for the person who only perhaps feels drawn to read a couple of books a year. You know, as I would say you're a discriminating reader.
I mean, there's maybe something in that. I know one of the things I deliberately did was kept it in small chunks, because I know I've got a very short attention span as a reader. And, you know, if I'm reading in bed, which is now when I do a lot of my reading, you know, there'll be the sort of, I'll flip forward to see how long the next chapter is to see if I've got the time, wakefulness and will to live to do another one. And I think there's something that makes it slightly Moorish with the little chunks of diary. And also, you know, I write as I speak. It's relatively unfussy language. So yeah, I don't know, whatever I did, I accidentally got it right rather than deliberately.
So what have you been reading that has really surprised you? What have you found sort of unexpectedly propulsive?
I read Mark Watson's new book, which is called Contacts. And this falls into the category of books written by friends, which, as I'm sure you'll agree, the most nerve-wracking books to read, because you have to read them and then you sort of have to be nice. And this was one that I really loved. It was really interesting and well-written. It was about, you never know what counts as a spoiler, but given this is on the back cover and like the first and second pages, I'm probably happy spoiling the fact that a guy gets on a train from London to Edinburgh and sends a message out to all of his contacts that he's going to take his own life. And it's the story of, you know, of what happens there. And it's, you know, it's called Contact. It's sent to his contacts, but it's actually a story about, you know, the contacts we have in life and friendship and loneliness and social media. And I thought for a time of peculiar isolation, it was quite a timely book. Also, it's obviously the heaviest of subjects, but it was dealt with an incredible lightness of touch. And I just thought, and it was very cleverly done. I was about halfway through and I suddenly realized, oh wow, this would have been really, really difficult to write the way it basically tells his story through flashback and through the present day of all the various people in his life. And it comes together in a really clever way that I didn't notice at first and until I sort of thought about it as a writer.
That sounds really compelling. And I think that's a really interesting idea that we know so many people in a way that's, I guess, peripheral for want of a better word, people that we sort of like and love in an abstract, quite two-dimensional way, and we sort of touch hundreds and thousands of lives without really touching them. And I think feeling a little bit responsible for everyone, but also a little bit too exhausted to do anything about it.
Yes, lockdowns meant that I've made contact with a lot of people I probably wouldn't have spoken to in peacetime. Like they'd appear on my Facebook or something, and I'd be like, oh, I should just Zoom them. We should just catch up for half an hour or an hour. And, you know, the sort of people who I probably wouldn't, no offence to them, you know, sort of go out of my way to have dinner with, or give over a whole evening to. But it was nice to spend half an hour with them.
And I suppose, you know, when all of the friction is taken away, the having to leave your house and get to their house or get to wherever and, you know, book somewhere and go home from it and do that planning, that's quite a... it changes things, I think, doesn't it? When you can just purely enjoy someone's company, albeit through a screen.
It does. And whilst lockdown has obviously been hugely isolating for lots of people, hopefully for others, it's allowed them to communicate more. And like his book, there's a lot of social media on it. And I found myself wondering if social media is more isolating or if it's more connecting. I suspect the book is intended to make you ask that question. I always wonder when I'm reading a book and I think of a theme that I've spotted, if the author ever meant that to be a theme. And I know that because I always suspected in like GCSE English, when we were reading, you know, whatever book we were being forced to read and we were being, you know, had to do an essay on the theme that colour plays in The Great Gatsby or something. And I was thinking, did it really mean that to be a theme, or have you just made that up because you're an English teacher? And then my first book's been now sort of read enough that it seems to have, appeared on people's essays, and occasionally people contact me because it's quite easy to find an author these days. On, you know, it's easier to get in touch with me than Scott Fitzgerald. They'll try and cheat on their homework by sort of sending me a note saying, you know, what did you mean by X, Y, and Z, or, you know, the common theme of something or other. And I'm like, yeah, really didn't mean that at all. No, you're reading stuff into it that wasn't there in the first place.
You're in good company, because I heard a story once about that happening with Alan Bennett, and that I think something he'd written was used as sort of like an English literature analysis. And someone wrote to him begging for like a good quote they could use for the exam. And he said, look, just make anything up and I'll put my name to it. If anyone checks, I'll say, yes, of course, I said that. you mentioned Alan Bennett before, and David Sedaris and Nora Ephron and Bill Bryson. Are there any books there or pieces of writing that you found at a formative time in your life or that you remember discovering and being excited by?
Alan Bennett was the first person I read who made me realise that writing could be funny and silly and involving and engaging. Because as one of the world's non-natural sort of readers, most of the reading I'd done was reading that I'd been forced to do. And if you force anyone to do anything, they're probably not going to enjoy it. It's why I think that it's one of the reasons that this kids' book, Kay's Anatomy, happened, because I think kids aren't interested enough in the human body, even though I think it's fascinating, because they're forced to sit down on an uncomfortable chair and hear about it. But Lady in the Van, I read, and I was like, oh, wow, yeah, I like reading. I like reading this, at least. There's relatively little funny stuff written, or there certainly wasn't when I was 18. I don't know if that's hugely controversial, or maybe a better way of putting it is I always found the bar for what was meant to be funny was set relatively low. A book would be described as laugh out loud, and I wouldn't be able to even work out which bit I was meant to be laughing out loud at. I've always been very drawn to the funny. And so all of those names that I mentioned, Bryson, Sidaris, Nora Ephron particularly, Alan Bennett, are people who have made me laugh out loud, which is the highest praise that I can give to an author if they make me do that. I think there's a lot more comic writing now, and it happens more often now, but certainly, I mean, I wish that at school we'd have been, you know, on the list of things we were forced to read, there was some lighter material, because I think it shouldn't just be about interpreting Brighton Rock, The Tempest, which are, you know, doubtless brilliant things. But I think part of the role of teaching English should be to get kids obsessed with reading in a way that they slightly failed to with me. And I'm now 20 years on, sort of learning to love reading.
I love Jane Austen, but when you're sort of a preteen and reading at school, she is presented as like the last word in hilariousness and literature. And you do have to look for it. You know, like if this is supposed to be, you know, rolling on the floor, rip-roaring funny, then I give up. But I remember when I was a kid, my mum and dad are huge Victoria Wood fans, as am I. And they had the books of the plays, and I used to memorise those. And it was seeing, because obviously you give so much credit to, you know, the performance, and yeah, she's amazing and Julie Walters is amazing, but just seeing the way she uses language and how it works written down and hearing those rhythms in your head. You know, I love that. Things like that really made me want to read.
Yeah. No, I'm enormous Victoria Wood fan. In fact, I've got the biography on my bedside table.
Have you ready started? To read. I'm excited, but also a bit terrified as well, in the way that I want her to be, in the way, you know. So I've got this very intimate and special relationship with this incredibly famous woman who had billions of fans and is now very sadly dead, and I don't want that relationship to change.
No, I mean, I read a review of it, which made me much more excited to read it than I even was before. So it's told with love, and I know the audiobook was recorded by loads of her friends and her colleagues, which makes me think it has to be a loving. I listened to, talking about audiobooks, I think audiobooks might now be the way I consume books the most. When I was like driving to gigs and things, I've been on this sort of perpetual, I don't know if it's a book tour or if it's a stand-up comedy tour or whatever it is, sort of standing on stage and sort of reading out from my book. Audiobooks are, you know, are a godsend for passing the drive to Newcastle. Is it reading? It is reading.
It's definitely reading, I think.
Yeah. And so that's, you know, audiobooks have definitely increased my reading.
What makes you reach for an audiobook? Is it just a book you want to read? Or do you think there's a difference between what's fun to read and what's fun to listen to?
If something's read by the author, I think that's, for nonfiction, that certainly makes me more likely to use up my Audible token on it.
Precious credit.
I don't know. I mean, there are some audiobooks that are terrible because they've been badly narrated, which is, I guess, the risk that you take, because at least when I read a book myself to myself, I know how bad the narration is. You know, less so recently, actually, there seems to be in the last couple of years much more of an effort to make the audiobook like a separate and distinct bit of publishing. Mm. In fact, I mean, there are some books where I've bought both.
Oh, like what?
Like the Alan Partridge's.
Yes.
Where I read the book and loved the book, and then someone said, "Have you listened to the audiobook?" And I was like, "No, I've read the book." And I said, no, do it. And I did. And I mean, they were just a whole new level.
It is a new dimension. The one, where he does the footsteps of my father walk. Because I was trying to listen to that while I was running. And I just struggled so much to not think that it was me with a big tent on my back, like going down into a carriageway. It was a little too immersive, but it was great.
For the book I've just done, this kid's book, I think out of mostly laziness, so I didn't have to read the whole thing, we sort of reimagined every chapter. It goes sort of organ by organ through the body. And we imagined every chapter as a conversation between an organ and me. So I was trying to like read the audiobook and they were just sort of annoying me and sort of with their facts. And
so did you get to cast the organs?
Yeah, we got to cast the organs. Yeah, which was amazing. So like Sandy Toksvig is the brain, and we had Reese Shearsmith as an evil German, Mark Gatiss as Dracula for the blood chapter, and Lolly Adafopi's in there, and Joe Wilkinson and Tom Allen and Lucy Montgomery and all sorts of brilliant people. So sort of end up getting quite carried away with that. I don't know how big a market kids' audiobooks are. I suspect not as big as adult, but...
this 35-year-old wants one.
Excellent. I think they're an important bit of publishing. I've never been very good at reading on screen, so I'm not a Kindle-y person, but audiobooks and good old-fashioned chop-down trees.
Did you listen to books on tape, like on long car journeys when you were little or anything like that?
I did, yeah. Well, I've not really thought about that. But yeah, the Just William tapes we had. There was a lot of P.G. Woodhouse, who sort of loomed weirdly big in my life, because I went to the same school as him in different years. But he was their big success. So everything that could be named after P.G. Woodhouse was named after P.G. Woodhouse, which I thought was slightly unfair on Raymond Chandler, who also went there. But anyway,
that's a triumph for comedy. Although, I mean, I love P.G. Woodhouse and I think those books are so funny. But if everything is happening in the Woodhouse Memorial Hall, or, you know, it's P.G. Woodhouse there, I can imagine how you might feel a little bit like, must everything be... It might put you off Jeeves.
Yeah, no, I do. No, that, and he is one of the great comedy writers, of course. Comedy changes, doesn't it, a bit? Like, yeah, you were saying about Jane Austen. The stuff that are described as Shakespeare comedies, they do really have to explain to you where the jokes are. I was researching for my kid's book, Shakespeare fart jokes, because something about like the oldest joke ever discovered by historians was some sort of fart joke in the like, ancient Sumerian or whatever it was. And then I just looked up, you know, this ended up not going in the book, but the jokes that Shakespeare had told. I, you know, it did need a good explanation of why this line was a fart joke. I'm sure Shakespeare was excellent at what he did, but I don't rate his gags.
Well, I suppose it's a reminder as well, isn't it, that he was very much kind of playing to the gallery, that he wasn't... I mean, I find it cheering that the jokes might not work now, but he wasn't above a fart joke, that the function of a fart joke, it was as necessary then as it is today.
Yeah, no, I'm never going to do down the fart joke.
I mean, I feel a little bit that way. Maybe I'm being a millennial snowflake, but I think about, you know, Martin Amis and how... When I was younger, I loved how sort of thrillingly nasty he was. And his comedy was just so brutal and cruel. And now it's a bit much. I'm like, the real world is horrible enough without this.
Yeah, good point. I'd say it's a good point. I've never read any Martin Amis. So I'm just going to nod.
Buckle up for cruel jokes.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
We'll be back to Adam soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week. On Turpentine Lane by Eleanor Lippman is the story of Faith Frankel, a Brooklyn transplant who's just returned to her suburban hometown to buy the perfect bargain home. And her sweet, ordered world gets weird when she learns some unexpected facts about the previous occupants. This is an exceptionally sophisticated rom-com. Faith's world is filled with people who are impossible not to love, like and recognise. It's a salted caramel treat of a book, undeniably cosy, but witty, sharp and wry enough to stop your teeth from falling out. On Turpentine Lane by Eleanor Lippman is out now. Now, back to Adam. What would you most like to read that you've not got round to yet?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, there's just so much. Ideally, I want people to stop writing books for a while so we can all catch up.
God, yes.
But you see these 100, you know, books to read before you die lists. I'm like, oh, God, I've read two of them. And one of those was The Very Hungry Caterpillar or whatever. And so there's I'll discover, you know, an author and then be like, oh no, they've written seven books. How am I gonna ever catch up with all of that? I'll be re-reminded of an author. And then Jonathan Coe, I read What a Carve Up years ago. And then delighted to Twitter threw up that there was a recent book and I ordered it and it's on my bedside table and I turned the flap and of course he's written, so that's added to the list as well.
I would say that his book The House of Sleep is one of my favourites, and I don't know if it would be in any way medically interesting for you or a busman's holiday, but it's fair, and I have no idea how accurate it is. I believed it all. And it's about different characters and the effect that their sort of insomnia or sleepfulness plays in their lives. And it's really, it's probably his least funny book, but it is very funny in places. And it's very sort of scathing about people. It's just, it's really, really moving and very emotionally resonant. It's really stayed with me. And I loved What a Carve Up and I loved The Rotters Club, but it's just something a bit. But I would say it's a very, like, a pretty quick read as well. I remember being quite surprised by, because the cover is, I think, it's like a blue-grey photo of a bed and it looks a bit sort of, you know, laconic and like, oh, this isn't going to be thrills a minute. And then when you look up, you're like, oh, I've read 10 chapters without realising.
Yeah, well, you made the mistake of judging a book by its cover.
That's the second sin after reading on the toilet.
I read the Matthew Walker book, Why We Sleep.
Oh, I have not, and I would like to.
The thesis of the book is we're not sleeping enough, and it's really, really important we sleep, and it's just as important as exercising or eating correctly or breathing and stuff like that. That was interesting. So yeah, that was hadn't really thought about sleep much before that. So, yeah, I'll put that on the
Does
list.
Does he tell you how to sleep if you're not sleeping? Because I feel like it's like going into a room and someone saying, "Oh, you look tired." Like, thanks.
Yeah, there is a bit of that, but I've always slept well. I sleep with Drone In Radio on in the background.
Oh, what station?
So it's mostly LBC.
And, blimey.
So I wake up really, really right wing and angry. it's Five Live or Radio 4 or Talk Sport or just something. So there's some noise, and I've done this since I was about 12 or 13, when I used to sleep with a little battery radio, sort of beige radio thing, under the covers next to my ear, which I wasn't, my parents banned me from doing because I was getting through so many batteries. So, and my husband used to hate it. And then I was originally banned from having the radio on, which meant I couldn't sleep. And then he bought me a pillow that you plug in to the radio and it plays it just in your pillow. So only you can hear it. But now he's given up and it's just always on in the background and he's got used to it too.
Oh, I'm glad you said that because I really wanted to ask about how that sort of thing affects a marriage. But this pillow sounds like a magical device. I can't believe that such a thing exists.
Yeah, it's really good. And somehow it's not, or maybe I'm just not the princess in the pea, but I couldn't feel any sort of machinery in it. It just feels like a normal pillow.
I wanted to ask you if you had any thoughts about, you know, is reading good for our mental health? I think it is. I do feel a bit calmer and more relaxed, depending on the book. I think if it's Andy McNab, possibly not.
I think you need a way of going into standby mode of how whatever it is, whether it's running or reading, or for me, it's playing the piano, because I like playing the piano, but I'm not good enough at it. So it requires 100% of my processing power to concentrate on playing the piano, which means I can't worry about all of my horrible deadlines, all the stuff I haven't done and all the various things happening in my life. So while I'm playing the piano, that totally looks after me. And reading plays a similar role. Often for me, reading's stressful though, if I'm reading it because I've got to read it, because I'm reviewing it, or someone wants me to quote for it or something like that, then I'm reading it. I'm not totally immersed in the world. I'm also thinking about, what sensible things I can say about it. But for people who love reading, reading is the perfect thing to do. And for people who don't yet love reading, it may well be the thing that they need to do.
Oh, but that is so stressful, though, because how on earth can you lose yourself in a book when you've got this constant external frame of, I must harvest up a quote, or I must, you know, put these thoughts in order. It's just more work.
It is, that becomes work. So actually, there haven't been that many books that I've read for fun recently. That's sad, isn't it? Maybe I need to...
And what do you like beyond, other than funny? Do you have any qualifiers?
I think funny is my top trump. I like I like twisty as well. I'm not very good at clever. If it's won one of the proper prizes, it's probably going to be a bit much for me. But then again, I'm not sure there's. I need to have any shame in that, just like there's types of music that I don't like as much as others and films that I'll watch above others. I sort of, books that make me really concentrate and then turn back some pages to work out what was going on, or it's sort of, or books where everyone says it's amazing, but nothing really happens. And they say, oh, no, it's not meant to. It's a character study. Those ones are off the list.
Oh, God, like TV, like you've got to watch the first four seasons to really get into it.
Yes. Yeah, no, I don't. How about I watch none of those seasons? Save myself 16 hours.
Have you read Love, Nina by Nina Stibbe?
Yes, I have. That's really good.
And what I loved about that as well is, as you say, it's got the brevity. So it's... I find every single line funny and so well crafted, but also it wouldn't give you piles. not that you're going to start coming back to the whole area, but you know, if you just want to, you have 2 minutes and you want to read something before bed that will put a smile on your face, you can. But also, I found it quite addictive. And the thing I think about a lot is at the very end, and because I think she's so good in that book on, you know, the pretension of it and being someone who. It feels like she is finding literature relatively late and she's getting ready to go to university, and sort of because she's not been at school, there are these gaps in her knowledge, but she is really smart. And I think she's writing something for college about Carson McCullers. And the essay is geared around how Carson McCullers was sort of a miserable recluse. And then she finds this book and said it might as well be called something like Carson McCullers Life as a Fun, Sociable and Popular Person. And so rather than change the essay, she takes the book out of the library and just hides it so no one can check.
Now that was a good, I'd forgotten about that book. So maybe I've read 11 books rather than 10.
But it is a little like, I always go back to Adrian Mole if I'm in need of cheer.
Oh, yes. Love Adrian Mole. I mean, with no offence to Samuel Pepys or Anne Frank or me, I guess, far and away the best diaries ever written. Sue Townsend was just an absolute genius. And it's a book that I reread when? About a year ago. There was a musical of it which was dead jolly, and I really enjoyed, and it made me go home and be sad that I couldn't find my original copy of it, but I ordered a fresh one, and it still works, which is great.
I mean, I'd love to know, I don't know if you've been asked this a lot before, but if I was in a position to go around prescribing books, I think all of the Teenage Diaries of Adrienne Mole, that would probably be on the list or near the top. Do you have any other books that you've loved that you think you'd like to, like the world to read, other than your own?
Other than my own, obviously, the only important books. I don't know. To be honest, if I know a book, then probably everyone knows it, because, you know, I'd love to be much more literature-y than I am. There was a book that I read at school, which I really liked. I mean, when I was young at school, but a sort of, no one who I mention it to has ever heard of, and I'm not sure if they've ever read it or if it's even still in print. It was called The Phantom Tollbooth by Norton Juster. It was a sort of fantastical story about this kid called Milo in all sorts of strange worlds, and it was very funny, and I guess it was ultimately about education and the importance of learning and thinking, but it was just a real hoot, and that can go on my list.
And that's something that I've not read as an adult, but now you said that, I would quite like to. I don't know if you've come across, Lucy Mangan wrote a memoir, and I think it's called Bookworm, a memoir of childhood reading. I'm looking over at producer Dale to check that I've got the title right.
I've not read that, no, but I do love Lucy Mangan.
I think that, because it's beautiful but funny and very readable. And it's really about her life as a person who just wanted everybody to go away so she could concentrate on her books. But she writes about all of those lovely childhood friends in such an evocative and comforting way. And it is like, you know, meeting all of those books that you really, really loved again for the first time, and it sort of reminds you of them. And I think that if you wanted a comfort read, and also it again it's written in that very sort of digestible way, so you don't feel like it's dense, you can sort of quite periodic, I guess, in the way that it goes through different stages of childhood. Also, I never get to recommend books to people on this podcast. Normally they're like, here's my list.
Oh yeah, sorry.
No, this is brilliant. I'm loving it. I hope you're not feeling too bamboozled by my, or bombarded. Kathy Rensenbrink's latest book, Dear Reader, which I can't shut up about. One of the things I adore about that is that Kathy is very involved in adult literacy, and I love her writing style so much, and she's got this incredibly funny, smart, and just a really like pure, clear way of looking at things and describing things, but it is written to be really gripping and really sort of easy to read, but not in a way where you think, oh, this is a bit simple. It's more a sort of an energy and a pacing of it.
Great. Yeah, well, I own that book, but I haven't read it yet. But I really, really loved The Last Act of Love, her first book, which was just beautifully written, but very tragic, about the death of her brother many years ago. And in fact, Kathy was the first person who ever interviewed me about my writing, about my I think it was in the Chiswick Book Festival 3 or 4 years ago. And then after that, she wrote A Manual for Heartache, which is it's a book that I've bought as gifts half a dozen times, because it's just, she writes so wonderfully and powerfully, and it's A Manual for Heartache is exactly what it says on the tin, and it's a great book. So yeah, I should have read Dear Reader by now, because I know it's going to be good.
But sometimes I think that if you know you're going to love something, you almost want to save it for pudding. if you know you've got, there are books you've got to read and books you want to read. But I do. I mean, what always stuns me about Kathy and how clever and kind she is, and I'm a little bit in love with her. I'm a very big fan of her and her work. She writes about these incredibly sad things, but she writes about being angry and confused and numb and the shock of, you know, that you will, the most awful thing you can think of will happen, and you will find something funny, and then you'll be furious with yourself for finding anything funny in this new universe. Just the humanness of it. I think he's one of the most human writers I know.
Hard agree. That's and one of the most honest writers.
Mm.
You really feel you know her, having read her books, and that's job done, isn't it?
Because it's hard. Lots of people say, oh, you know, writing, it must be like therapy. I'm like, no, not really. To present your experiences in a way that is engaging and entertaining and interesting, let alone anything more profound than that, you know, you're not just burbling it up. It is work.
It is work. I think writing can be therapy. And I think it sorted me out a bit. The way my first book ends is about the reason I left the medical profession, and which was a bad day at work on labour ward. And when you're on labour ward, the bad days are really quite horrible. And it was, you know, more than I could deal with. And I ended up leaving. The culture amongst doctors is one that you don't talk about this kind of thing, to the extent that when it was published, I was getting email after email from doctors saying they thought they were the first person who'd ever cried in the toilet or cried in the locker room and things. It's that sort of deeply baked into what it means to be a doctor. And I hadn't talked about this thing that had happened. Hadn't happened to me, it had happened to, you know, a patient and their family, but, you know, I'd been a bit of collateral damage to that, and it had had its impact on me. I hadn't, you know, my parents didn't know why I'd left medicine, my friends didn't know, my partner didn't know. And then it wasn't, I'm not sure if it was therapeutic writing it down and having it published, and just sort of, it was sort of, the editing process was sort of relatively clinical. I think editing is, you know, it's just, you know, should we move that comma, and does that need double inverted commas or single? You know, that's that sort of stuff. That was more like presenting it. But then being interviewed about it to a certain extent, but more than that, getting up on stage, which I've now done many hundreds of times, and reading it out has been very beneficial to me. In fact, I don't know if it's PTSD, because I sort of slightly skimmed my psychiatry lectures, but it's certainly post-traumatic something. I used to regularly wake up back in the operating theatre where it happened, with my heart going at 200 beats a minute, and I'd be in a cold sweat, and I'd jolt fully upright. And that doesn't happen anymore. So something's happened to those demons since the book has been published and since I've been talking about it. I think that it has helped me.
I wonder whether any part of that is knowing that being able to share something so terrifying and painful has a function, that ultimately what was so, so, so hard for you has actually changed things for so many people on a personal level, and even, you know, gone so far as to hopefully start changing the minds of people who are in a position to improve things for the doctors and for the NHS and for medicine, that it's a little bit Mr. Rogers, I think. You know, if it's human, it's manageable. If it's manageable, it's mentionable. But I've said this before, I love reading because we we find ourselves and we escape ourselves at the same time. And I think it, you know, so many people have found themselves and been so comforted and relieved to meet themselves, either in a literal way with experiences that were very, very close to what you went through, or anyone who has just experienced any kind of pain and shame and anxiety and has been comforted to have company.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very well put and very interesting. I hadn't really thought of things like that. Yeah, you're very good at your job.
Well, no, I was thinking about that a lot in the pandemic. I think that what we all want to do is help, and we can't help in the ways that we're used to. I think that everyone really wants to feel useful. Everyone really wants to feel they have a function, and it's harder to find those things. And that's, I think, what so much of what motivates us as humans. And when I need to look for hope to find that we're, you know, we're good and decent and we're not sort of terrible selfish beasts, that whether it actually works or not, and actually thinking about what's happening politically at the moment, and there are lots of arguments against this, but also in some small way we're all trying to invent a reason to be needed.
Yeah, I think I felt that very acutely, having previously been in a job where I was definitely useful. That's uncontroversial. If you're on the front line and you're doing cesarean sections, that's pretty A-game society useful. To suddenly being, writing TV shows and now books and things. And obviously the arts have a measurable value, but it's a few notches away from saving lives. And I didn't really feel that particularly deeply until the pandemic, and I realized what my friends and my former colleagues were still doing, and I felt a profound helplessness, which actually ended up resulting in pulling together a book it was 100 letters from famous people that I sort of I collated, saying basically thank you to the NHS, and it's called Dear NHS, that I did to raise money for charity, which it did do for NHS charities predominantly. But it was also a selfish act because it gave me a way of not feeling so useless.
I think we all have to be a little bit selfish, or we'd go mad. You know, we've all got egos and anxieties. Made me think of two things. And what I don't, have you read ever How to Be Good by Nick Hornby, which might be a little too close for home because it is about a doctor?
I haven't read that for that reason. I mean, I love Nick Hornby and I've read a lot of Nick Hornby, but it's the reason that I don't watch medical dramas on telly either.
I mean, I don't think you see, I think she's called Kate, the main character who is a doctor. She's always thinking, I must be a good person. I'm a doctor. You know, I dedicate my life to doing something that's useful. I must be good. I must be. But then everything her life throws up, like, absolutely tests that. And I think that something happens, and I can't remember if her husband either starts giving away all their possessions, but also he starts inviting homeless people off the street to live with him, and he makes everyone in the street take in a homeless person in the spare room. And their children are sort of very confused, and they're being quite hard work, and they're the sort of an impressionable age. But it's as a kind of modern morality story, as in, you know, what function do our morals have, and is there natural goodness, or are we all ultimately self-interested? The other one is, I've just read the new Zadie Smith book, Intimations, also a noble fundraising book. And I think her impulse, and she writes about it, is the same as yours, where she's like, well, I felt utterly useless. And I realised that being a writer is one of the most useless things you can be in the scheme of it all. What can I do? And she talks about the why I write essay, or the why I write piece, and how, you know, every pompous author has sort of thought about that at some point in their careers, as has she. And she says, well, really, there's nothing more to it than it's something to do.
Yeah, no, I should read that. I mean, she's obviously an amazing writer. Done. Deal.
Excellent. I will promise it will take no more than, you know, an afternoon of your time. But she is, I think, another writer where her reputation is very sort of grand and literary. And I've loved her for a long time. And I think I loved her most of all because when I read White Teeth, I don't know if I got it for Christmas or something. And I thought, oh, this is one of those like mum and dad books where like, read this. And I was like, but this is really good. This is really sharp and thrown into the deep end of this book.
Yeah, I read it when it was already a classic, which I think is one of the worst things that can happen to a book in terms of wanting you to read it. But I totally agreed. It's a classic because it's brilliant.
What do you think is the most overrated book? What have you been excited to read or felt obliged to enjoy and just thought, bugger this, and given up?
I used to always finish books because otherwise the book had won. And, but now I've got less of my life left than I had before and a longer pile of books on my bedside table. I don't review books if I don't like them, which means that quite often people think I'm reviewing books and I don't, but I think that's the best thing I can do. There was a book I once reviewed. I reviewed it well, but it was a nice review, but at the end I did make some criticism. I made it in the context of a good review, and I made sure there were some good pull quotes that the publishers could take out and do what they wanted with. But I thought the important thing was for me to review it like I was reviewing a restaurant, and I don't want people to unnecessarily spend their money if it's not the sort of thing they'd like to. And the author, you know, had a go at me on social media, told me I didn't get it. And I think I did get it and I did mean it, but it made me realise that I'd upset them and that wasn't what I want to do. So now if I'm reading a book professionally, inverted commas, and it's not for me, then I just draw a line under it. And I'm obviously not going to mention any of those for exactly the same reason. But someone I'm probably not going to upset the estate of, and I think they'll probably be fine without my backing, is Tolkien. And it's not that I don't like fantasy, because I do. I just don't like those books. I just can't be bothered with reading 20 pages about trees. and I know I'm meant to. And if I could be a thousandth as successful as those books were, then I'd be extremely happy. But not everything can be for me, and that, you know, that wasn't for me.
I am with you. I often think, and obviously, you know, there are, like, as you say, he's fine. He does not need either of us. But I've had a go and I thought, this feels like it was much more fun for him to write than it is for me to read.
Yeah, that's a very good description. Yeah.
I feel bad finishing on a on a Tolkien bitch.
I think, in fact, every one of your episodes should end slagging off Tolkien.
I'm going to bring that in, make that official podcast policy.
Yeah.
It's been so, so lovely to talk to you.
Sorry I haven't read any books and so can't usefully contribute to your podcast, but I like the way it works in reverse, where you tell me what to read.
It's really nice to have a conversation about the function of reading and how it shows up in people's lives.
Oh, and I forgot on my list of diaries, Bridget.
Of course.
That's another wonderful book. That's another very funny book, actually. Oh, well.
I can't believe that I didn't think about Bridget when you said, because I was just thinking of her. Bridget has borrowed a dress from Jude to impress at a, it might be the Law Society dinner, and it's Evil Rebecca says, oh, I see you're wearing last year's John Rocher. I recognise the hem is such a brilliantly mean comic line.
No, amazing. Love it. Yeah. And I've not read that book for years. I reckon I should again. I reckon it holds up.
It really, and it's so lovely. I really like think, what was I doing? Or what am I doing today? What was Bridget doing in imaginary land in the 90s? Back on October 26th. Reread Bridget Jones, the ultimate comfort read.
Yeah, really is. And no shame in comfort reading.
No, I'm a big, big fan. It's all we have now.
Yeah, it's true.
Huge thanks to Adam. Kay's Anatomy is going on my Christmas list. Buy it for the people you love. Buy it for yourself and learn all about your body. And Adam's anthology, Dear NHS, 100 Stories to Say Thank You, is out now too. I'm Daisy Buchanan and I've been your book inspector. Thank you so much for joining me. Your Book is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. You can follow us on social media at YBooked, and if you've enjoyed this episode, it would make me incredibly happy if you could leave us a 5-star review. It's the best way to help new listeners to find the podcast. Find the list of all the books mentioned by Adam at acast.com/booked. Finally, I leave you with this from E.B. White. I get up every morning determined to both change the world and have one hell of a good time. Sometimes this makes planning my day difficult. See you next time.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.